Session number 26590, General Wilhelm Moore, Reel 16. Still noisy in mono.
You were discussing an example of possible problem about nuclear release.
Yeah. Well, if you think about if you have an all out strike plan and so on, well, you are caught in a stream and you do things and it's fairly easy. But if you take the other side and say that Norway is being attacked in the north, and the commander up there judges that there's no way except using nuclear weapons, the procedure would be then that he sends his request for a nuclear weapon to the Allied headquarters where I was sitting in there. And it's being evaluated, and that evaluation comprises then a political representative nominated by the parliament and government, which is a trusted man for such that sort of question, supposed to be, and would be, and so on. And we would find that it's justified to use nuclear weapons, and then this request would be sent down to Brussels. Where the same thing would happen, there would be a representative of each country. And they would then discuss, is nuclear weapon really warranted, and what are the consequences for development, for, things are getting bigger and so on. And you end up in a World War and you say, so if you get a go after this, and it goes back to consuls, and then it goes up to the commander. Well, by that time, of course, you can't do that in less than, say, the best by daytime, mind you, in 6 hours and so on. It's nighttime. And things might have changed, and the commander up there might say, well, that's just too late, So it's complicated business, really, the whole thing. And I must say that also it was such a touchy thing that when we had this discussion out at consuls and so on, you found that they wouldn't come. The prime man, that would be the political man, he wouldn't come himself. He would probably send somebody. So he wasn't really caught on something that could be embarrassing to be confronted with later in the discussion. And so there you are. They came for the dinner after the exercise and so on. But we this is saying it a little sort of, well, it is truth. But they were shy in sort of giving in view in certain things of that nature. I suppose that's the way it is. That doesn't mean that they won't be forceful enough if it was in real term. But that's the way you live. But the mixture of the mixture of military and civilian control, or the civilian control and the military sort of part of the machinery, to my mind, worked really good. And I would say that it might look sluggish, and it probably would be some sluggish. I always thought that, well, if it's a real case, there would be some shortcuts and so on that you can hopefully will work faster than this. But you've got to have cooperation too for this alliance, and unless you behave that way, well, it breaks down somehow.
Well, is it not a common characteristic of coalition warfare that you have to try and please everybody?
Yeah.
And that is, the more people there are involved, the more difficult it is.
But what can you afford in wartime and in peacetime? There's two different things.
Of course. There's a great deal more urgency in wartime.
I've read Jenkins' book on Churchill now and so on, and I read about all the things in 1939 and so on, and my God, there was a lot of back and forth.
There was, and later on dealing with the Americans as well.
Yeah, course, yeah, sure. But you expect it. It should be like that.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting what you're saying, because it seems to me that in the 1950s, when thinkers like Sir John Slessor were writing about strategy, they regarded the atomic bomb as being simply a bigger bang.
Yeah.
But by the 1960s, things have changed, and the nuclear weapon was really more of a political instrument, a psychological pressure than a military weapon. The status had shifted. You seem to have been seeing the way that developed, the way the...
But that is why the flexible response idea got their chance, really.
Did you think that was a realistic approach to things, the flexible response
idea? Well, it developed, yes, I would say so. And it made the atmosphere somewhat different than it was before that. And, yes, it was. It was. I thought it was. I hesitated much at the time, I remember that. I thought that was... weakening, sort of, but it was a thing. It was.
It requires more support for its credibility, doesn't it?
Yeah. There was a need to get away from the all-out. Well, otherwise, it would be killed by public opinion, and the threat was still there. So, I mean, what do you do?
Compromise.
Yeah.
Did the standing group meet every day?
No, we didn't, but we met very often. And they all demanded that the report of the meeting was there in the early next morning. It took a lot of my time. And mind you, it isn't my mother language, really. Yes. But you get into a phraseology that you can use to a large extent. So I remember after a month in America, and in that job, I remember my wife came and said that she thought the children had difficulty with the language in the school. And I said, "You think they have difficulties? I have difficulties." But it evened out. But you had to do it yourself. I mean, it was having the pen in your hand and writing it. It wasn't anybody. Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, but it wasn't anybody writing it for you. And we didn't use dictaphones or things like that. You had to take it out. And, it was a little well.
Did you have the staff to help you prepare the?
Very little. I had a secretary, and then I had the secretary of the previous chairman. And in the last, I was helping him, the one that came afterward. That's why we did it, you know. So it was justified to have that system. I was very impressed by the way Standing Group really operated. They had some big issues, and they had a way of dealing. In particular, this British fellow, Admiral Denny. He was a clever, clever man. Really, it was. And I remember the way they, if somebody really was difficult and so on, and say, right, now you, for next meeting, come up with a proposal how you can make us align with your. And that was the normal way they did it. Now, you are the obstacle, you come up with a proposal of how to get us to not be the obstacle to you. And they were a good team.
Were the meetings held in a formal way, or were they informal?
We had both. Yeah, we had both. Something in the preparatory state, they could have informal meetings, yes, and then to sort out their thinking and directing for what should be in the paper. Of course, the secretary, we had secretary on logistic and operation, and one more, right? Infrastructure and so on. And then, apart from the others, came the intelligent people. They would never mix in, but they had meeting too within the framework of the NATO, but they were completely independent. They wouldn't, they had reasons of their own.
You're saying that there are some major issues about infrastructure. What were those about?
Not money. And then in the military committee, of course, we had a Dutch representative from Holland. He would he would wonder, you know, whether the room should be that big or that big, and all of what was a different, what was a very modern conscious development. We needed that too. It was all right. I had a good time in the standing group. Very, very, very good. Hard working, hard taxing, family wise and so on, but we had a good time.
Where were you actually living? Were you living inside Washington itself? Or?
I lived beginning outside in Alexandria, and then at the latter part we moved into Georgetown, in Washington itself. I liked both places, my wife too, and got very much in with the community, children, schools, and all. Was no problem.
Did you get used to the American way of life?
Very much so, yes. Very much so. And we... there was, of course, the French category. They were, because they had a principal in the standing group. They had a staff, and the British had a staff, and the American had a staff. The other one had two, but we saw mostly to them. And they were then, if you have numbers, so being in my position, I saw them more than the rest. They were closer to my work. Oh, happy time. Yes, good time. Of course, I was lucky with my own career because the secretary in the British system, and they followed the British system here, he's the one who signs the letters. The planners make the paper, and so on, and what goes out to various countries. The secretary signs them. So I signed a lot of very clever papers and so on. And in Norway, of course, they thought I had made those papers. So I came home and they thought, "You must be a clever fellow." There you are.
Certainly the case that in the British committee, the secretary is really in control.
Oh, yes.
Because it is the secretary who decides after the meeting what has been decided.
Yes. And what's the priorities next, yes. And what's the sort of avenues to follow, and what's the, oh, yes. But that goes in business too, you know.
Did you realize that it was going to be like that before you went there?
I knew it was going to be a pretty tough working job.
But did you know that you were going to be quite so powerful as secretary?
No. That was new to me. That the secretary system, it could be almost really frightening.
Is it different in Norway?
Yeah. Very different. At least as it was in my time. Yes. No, it was. They were clever, those principals, and they were fine to work with. Very fine to work with, I found. All of them. Different. Filling each other out. Or supplementing each other, and it was a nice group. And the planners and so on, it was a good environment to work in. Yes.
What about the Pentagon? Was that a good environment in which to?
Yes, I would say so. Yes. Children weren't all happy. They thought that my wife, we didn't acquire two cars, so she had the car. She brought me to Pentagon about 8 o'clock. She picked me up about 5:30 or something, and that meant that when we came home, then we had sort of settled certain issues towards children and so on and so on. They felt on the defensive when I came. They couldn't play me up against what they always, especially the elder daughter, she thought that it wasn't quite fair that we had sort of agreed upon things before she could meet us.
Inserted your strategy.
Yes. Well.
And you came back to, and you were DCOS when you came back to?
I was deputy to
Chief of Staff.
Yeah, Chief of Staff. And then I became Commander-in-Chief when General Bull went to this United Nations
yes.
thing.
What kind of man was he, General Wool?
Well, he... what should I say? of course, he came after Motzfeldt, and Motzfeldt came after Lambrecht. No, it was the other way around. Yes, it was after Motzfeldt. Motzfeldt was a very strong commander. He was, because we had this mutual aid program and so on, as I mentioned, it was sort of turning into the American, very much into American. Bull was sort of is reticent, in a word to say. He was more a little shy, in a sense, and certainly not as powerful as... He was a fine man as a person, but he wasn't the same.
Do you know what it was that attracted him to the United Nations and its service?
I would say so. I don't know. I don't really know. He wasn't a fellow that I would say was a sort of a dedicated go at this is what I want, otherwise I can't live. You know, it wasn't that. Although he was interested. He was socially interested. He was meet people and be around and all that. Yes.
Did he have diplomatic qualities? Do you think?
I wouldn't say particularly. He didn't offend people easily. He was good at that. But that. That's just the half part of it. Anyway.
What is the role of the deputy chief of staff? Did you have to act as his shadow to?
No, you coordinate papers for him, prepare
yes.
things, and see that the staff is working out the various consideration and evaluations of one thing and the other. It's a pretty work technique. It's a hard work job. You're always expected to be ahead of time.
Yes.
You become very much also a sort of go-between man in certain things.
Did you have a set range of duties, or were you really working ad hoc, depending upon what needed to be done?
Well, I don't know. How do you mean?
When you went to be DCOS, did the general say to you, these are the things that I want you to look after, and give you a...
Oh, yeah.
List,
yeah.
Or was it something different every week as something came up?
Yeah, but sometimes he had things he wanted to be analyzing. Bull was somewhat vague on that. He was sort of leaving it more to me to present things to him than really him giving directions for me to solve, you know, that sort of thing. But but of course, what should I say? As they go, did something. He wasn't the most forceful commander we had, but he was a nice fellow. Yeah. No harm in him at all. But he left me in a somewhat difficult position to more or less be be commander-in-chief over there, but not being it when he left. And it took a fairly long time before they took a year and a half or something before the minister said that he can't have it that way. Either Bull must have come home or he must stay out there. And I remember that Bull reflected on, he couldn't quite understand that. There was another country who had some sort of system where they allowed that sort of thing. But our Minister of Defense, he just wouldn't have it. And so the job was, as we do in our country, there were more names than me, but anyway, I got that job.
What's going on in the Air Force? Were there any changes being made or issues arising when you were DCOS before you took over?
Uh, No, not except the, well, it was, of course, the artillery. That was a big thing, and it was an internal thing in many ways. It was, but what I met, but I met it more later when I had the Air Force, was the organizational structure of the whole defense in Norway. It came up, this business of unified war, that the Joint Chief of Staff, the Joint Chief of Staff system was outdated. We must find another system, more of a commanding general on top of the thing, like the German system and the Swedish system too. And of course I was set on our system, which was your system. I liked the Joint Chief of Staff system. It suited my temperament too, I think.
Yes.
And I also felt that it was it gave a lot to me anyway, that we could sit and discuss army problems, navy problems and so on, and how we supplemented each other and so on, much better than having one sort of saying, this is the way I want it, you know, and so on. So I was much for the Joint Chief of Staff system. We had a big commission by the ministry, including military people, to come up with a formula for this. It was headed by a very well-known man called Jens Christian Hauge, who was a lawyer, brilliant lawyer, and he came up with a system of a joint command system and so on, which I, and with strong support by the Navy particularly, we managed to postpone.
Who's in favor of it?
Well, a fellow like Gunnarsson, if you've heard his name,
yes.
He was very for it. And some politicians were for it, not necessarily the defense minister. And it was, I would say, army was more for it than anybody else. It was typical that Navy and I found each other much more in common, I suppose. And anyway, it didn't happen. The people on the research side, especially this Finn Lead, brilliant fellow, friend of mine, he was very keen that this, the idea was not only, you see, to get rid of the Joint Chief of Staff system, but to get the commander of the so on into the environment of the politician, of the Ministry of Defense. And he was very keen that the research people should have influence, more influence in the actual direction of things. Now they had that influence anyway, but more sort of thing. I was mainly afraid that if you get that sort of lonely fellow, the military man, into that environment, which would count about 6 or 7 other people from various ministries, positions and so on, what would be of the military position in certain cases? You were outvoted on things and you were losing the grip and so on. So anyway, that was so on. Now, of course, you are getting just this sort of thing, so, but things have changed too, so.
Well, part of the purpose was always to allow politicians relatively more control than they had before.
Yeah.
Having achieved defense.
Well, my main argument on that one was really that look back on what happened in 1940 and so on, and that having a conscription system, that it's only fair to the public that they know what the military means. It hasn't to do with loyalty, you see, we'll subordinate ourselves to the political. So it isn't that question, but it's a question that the public at large, who have sons in the conscripts and so on in the military. They know what the military thinks about things and so on. So that was my main sort of thing, that you lose a military now position as towards the people. After all, it's everybody's people. So that was the thing. It's not being swallowed by political opportune circumstances and so on. To some extent, I'll stick to those ideas still, although I can discuss that differently today than those days. Now that we are sending people out and that sort of thing, it's not the round country and the round people and so on. The home defense, the difference. Anyway, there's so much difference that I won't go into that.
Yeah.
But I was even more against the same man. It was also made, and that succeeded on their part, with me breaking as much as I could, that in the district, in thinking particularly up north, that you should get too much sort of integration, in the sense that you would evaporate or you would weaken the influence of the professional leadership on the jobs that you are put to do. And I was always afraid that you should start using airplanes in a sort of unqualified way, because they are there, your weapons and so on, and that the people who actually look after the way of thinking of using the air should lose a position to influence. I was always afraid of that. You could misuse what you've got and all that. So it really comes down to you know, how to give the people who execute the job, give them a fair do with what you're asking them to do, and that was much on my mind. But I lost out on that one. It became a sort of in between, and it still is, of course, an influence, but it's an influence that can be overridden, and of course by command, and that is a dangerous point. I won't say that under certain circumstances it should not be overridden, yes, but it shouldn't be a part of a system that more or less makes it the general use. That would be, I would say, not fair to the people. So there we are. Well.